Today is August 1st, the year 2001. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Carolyn Stieber for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated in the year 2005. Professor Stieber, you can see we've got a tape recorder here. Do you give us permission to record this session?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some personal and educational questions about your background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school prior to college?
Okay, I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. I went to the University of Chicago for my undergraduate work. I then worked for the United States Navy as a civilian for a couple of years, first in Cincinnati, then in Washington, D.C. I transferred to another government program called the Veterans Emergency Housing Program, where I met my future husband. And at the beginning of the time that we were first married, we lived in Minneapolis. A year after that, we moved to Pittsburgh, and I attended the University of Pittsburgh and took a master's degree, both of my degrees in political science.
Mm-hmm. What interested you in political science initially?
In political science, the University of Chicago had an astoundingly fascinating faculty, some of whom were in Washington, because this was during World War II. But those who were still on the campus were teaching the courses that I thought were the most interesting of all the courses that I took. And I think it was one of those love at first listening things. It never occurred to me to major in anything else.
Interesting. Were you active in politics?
No, mm-hmm. Not in the sense of practical politics. But I have always been what you might call a political junkie. I read a tremendous amount of political news, and I'm just enormously interested in things political, but I have never held an elected office politically. I have mm-hmm. held other offices, but not that.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you came to Michigan State?
Okay. We came to Michigan State because Jack Stieber was offered a position with the newly formed Center and later School of Labor and Industrial Relations. When we first arrived with two small children, I was interested in going to law school. We had just finished paying for the years of Jack's PhD when we lived on his fellowships, and I had a small amount of earnings because I had been doing some editorial work for the Russian Research Center at Harvard. I wrote to the University of Michigan and to Wayne State. There was no law school in this area. There was no expressway between here and those places. And it appeared to me that if I were to go, I would have to live either in Detroit or Ann Arbor, and that was very unappealing with two little girls. Within 6 months, somewhat to my surprise, an individual who knew that I was still working on a book that I was trying to put into better English for the Russian Research Center at Harvard, someone who knew that here, mentioned my name when the political science department said that they had an emergency. We came in the spring of 1956. This was now, I think, December that same year. They needed to cover an evening course in American politics at the university in political science. Would I conceivably be interested? I had never thought of teaching in my entire life. I said, sure. And because it was in the evening, I didn't have to deal with babysitters and that sort of thing, My leg was trembling so much, Jeff, that I stood as hard as I could that first evening before that first class. But I had a wonderful time. And I think because I had worked in a couple of government agencies, and I had also been an intern at the Bureau of the Budget in Washington, I was able to make vivid for students some of the things that American government faced. It was a successful term. At the end of that quarter, the department asked me if I would do it again the next term, and I said yes. It began to branch out from just American politics to state politics and urban politics, so I did those three courses for several years. When the younger of our daughters was now in first grade, I decided that I could teach during the daytime instead of in the evening, which was a lot easier in many other ways. And eventually the Michigan politics class, which Charlie Press had taught for a couple of times, needed someone. And I took that over, and that became sort of my baby. And in fact, I wrote a short book because Michigan was changing very much politically at that point from a democratic regime of G. Menon Williams to the Republicans. It was extremely interesting, and I loved teaching. And I was always, of course, a sort of odd man out in the department because I did not have a PhD. I had never even considered such a thing. After doing this, though, for a number of years, I decided that I did not have the circumstances that were very reliable. I was really hired term to term, and even though I did keep teaching term after term and year after year, I wanted something more than that, and told the department that I was not willing to continue that way, at which point I was made an assistant professor with tenure. By now I had written lots of articles and I had published a book. The present governor of Michigan had been a student in my Michigan politics class, and the present secretary of energy was also in my class.
That's Spencer Abraham and John Engler, right?
John Engler, I had Spencer Abraham, and in fact the sheriff of Wayne County, Robert Ficano, is a former student of mine, so I have some names to drop too. The department was agreeable to changing my status. In the meantime, I did become involved in other things at the university, and I have never regretted that this is the way I went instead of the law school thing. To satisfy my law school aspirations, my younger daughter went to law school. It had nothing to do with me, of course, but nonetheless, we now do have a lawyer in the family.
Where did that time, the 1960s, was a great transition time in Michigan politics?
Oh yes.
Were you involved at all in the Constitutional Convention?
I know I wrote a monograph about the Constitutional Convention, and that got a fair amount of publicity. I attended numerous sessions. I talked to a great many people in preparing this monograph, and it was an interesting time because the Williams to Romney change was an enormous change in Michigan, and Romney was able to do some things which probably a Democrat could not have done, namely to get an income tax in Michigan. I don't think any Democrat would have succeeded in doing that, but he really pushed that very hard. I did interview then Lieutenant Governor Milliken. I had a session with Swainson. I met with G. Menon Williams. I never was able to interview Romney directly, but I did talk to three or four of his assistants, as well as the lieutenant governor, And I was able to talk to leaders in the House and the Senate and several people who were active in the convention. So I was extremely interested in the mm-hmm. in the convention.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When you say you interviewed them, did you tape record any of them, or would you take notes on that?
I didn't tape record, but I'm a pretty good note-taker. If mm-hmm. it were today, I would, of course, have a tape recorder. I've always had pretty good notes. And much later on, my good note-taking was to be a valuable resource. I should also tell you, I have one of the world's worst handwritings. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep notes confidential in the ombudsman's office, I never had to worry because nobody could read my writing.
Could read your writing.
Even I could not read it too well sometimes. But no, I didn't use any tape recording. But I did take extensive notes, and the people I interviewed did get copies before the book was published in case mm-hmm. they had some mm-hmm. changes or corrections.
What was the title of the monograph?
The monograph, I'm trying to think. I think actually I brought a crib sheet with me. I think I can probably. Now I just say I wrote an article on Michigan's Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure now what the title was. I could give it to you if you wanted it. Mm-hmm. I know the title of the book, but I've kind of forgotten what the monograph is called. Yeah. I'd written a couple of articles too before the convention. Mm-hmm. Michigan had a tremendously difficult financial struggle, which was being played out politically mm-hmm. in the legislature. The automobile industry was changing. It was doing a certain amount of relocating to the South. Mm-hmm. It was getting pushed by competitors from other countries. Mm-hmm. And it's the automobile industry's relationship on the management side to the Republican Party and on the workers' side to the Democratic Party was fairly unique in Michigan. There wasn't mm-hmm. any other state that had quite that stark division in a tremendous industry that really split along political lines. And Romney, of course, came out of that automotive mm-hmm. background.
American Motors.
And, right. And he was extremely sensitive to the relationships between the different forces in Michigan, and he knew pretty much what he could do and what he couldn't do. It was interesting because I think he was very astute in Michigan. He did not come over that way when he tried to play a larger role outside mm-hmm. The state, the mm-hmm. first campaigning for the presidential nomination and later in a cabinet position. I don't think his reputation was anywhere near what he had earned in Michigan. Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the campus in the 1960s when you were teaching?
Well, the campus was, of course, increasingly as the Vietnam War escalated, and that's not so much the early 60s, although it was really showing itself through the whole decade. There were a lot of adventures on campus. I remember broken windows. I remember demonstrations of all kinds. There were professors who canceled classes. And this, of course, is the reason that an ombudsman's office was established on this campus. Mm-hmm. And you haven't asked me that question yet, but I assume
I'm not there, but it will come to that. Many of your colleagues, go ahead.
Well, political science was particularly divided, and I can remember vividly at department meetings, folks over there didn't talk to the folks over there. A lot of members of the department had been involved in Vietnam.
In the Vietnam Project.
Exactly, and had been advisors, had been over there for years, and there was a great deal of hostile feeling between those who felt very bitterly that this was not a war that the United States should be pursuing, and others who were very much committed to it. And there was even a very big reception, I remember, at the Kellogg Center when the president of Vietnam and his wife and somebody else were here, and Menon Williams, I guess, was still the governor at the time. And it was a tremendous involvement that Michigan State had in Vietnam.
And this was President Ngo Dinh Diem.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And that definitely showed itself in the department. I guess because I was the only female in the department for 10 years and had this rather odd status anyway, I was never one of the boys. And so I attended department meetings, but I never really was caught up in these divisions. But I can tell you they were very deep and very hostile. Mm-hmm. And political science was sort of the eye of the storm in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Wesley Fischel was a colleague at
definitely.
The when the Ramparts article was published, that must have created a furor.
Absolutely.
On campus.
Absolutely. I remember at a memorial service for Wesley Fischel in the chapel here, when, given some of the people who were there and who spoke kind words, President Wharton said to me, "Lots of hypocrites here today."
They'd forgotten the earlier words. How was it that the Office of the Ombudsman came about?
Got established. Well, of course, I didn't establish it. James Rest, as you may know, was the first ombudsman. This really came, I will try to not give you the long-winded answer to that. This really came out of a study done by the Carnegie Commission that had been headed by Clark Kerr. Now, Clark Kerr had been caught in the disruption in California, and he was famously fired by Ronald Reagan, who was then the governor. Kirby Hake came the head of the Carnegie Commission, and they did a number of studies in universities, and one of them was called Dissent and Disruption. And in that particular volume, the suggestion was made that universities might try a idea that had germinated centuries ago in Scandinavia, to have somebody who was perceived as a neutral to handle complaints and grievances. And this university turned out to be the first school of any importance. President Hanna must have been persuaded when he read that volume. I think Eastern Montana holds the record for establishing the very first office, but this was the first place of any consequence that established one. And so when James Rust was appointed, he became in many ways a template, so to speak, for other offices that were to come afterward. And there was a good deal of correspondence, which I read long ago in the office, of other schools writing to him. I can tell you now that there are probably 150 college and university ombudsmen. There are even some in other countries. I know there's one in Cork, Ireland, and there are a couple in New Zealand, and I think there's some in other places too, and all across Canada. And it mushroomed very, very fast, because it gave some flesh to the concept that there would be someone presumably independent and reporting to a high-level person, and in this case to the president, directly to the president of the university, who would be in a student's corner if something was unfair that upon investigation seemed to need some remedy. Now, that doesn't mean that the ombudsman didn't hear lots of stuff that was just, you know, complaints because they didn't, they thought they deserved a 4-point when they only got a 3-5 and they worked so hard. It was also a time, Jeff, when it wasn't just the war. It was part of post-war America in the sense that universities had grown so fast and were very bureaucratic and almost impossible for a full-time student to take the time to work through what might not to us seem like a big problem, but was what something that was terribly frustrating to them. Their housing application had been lost and the residence hall said, "We never heard of you, we're full, you can't come in," that sort of thing. And the tremendous bureaucratization, and particularly in state universities, because they're the ones that really grew probably the most and the fastest. I think that fed into a sense on the part of students that they were sort of lumpen proletariat, nobody cared about them. In addition, it has always been the case, wartime probably makes it more so, but I think it's always the case, that a certain number of faculty are not on campus. They're doing consulting work. They're doing it for the government, they're doing it for private industry, they're everywhere but where they're supposed to be. And therefore, the teaching of the classroom is a rather low priority because most departments are not going to promote you on what a terrific, inspiring teacher you are. They're going to look at your publication record and so forth and so on. And so the absence of faculty and I think the perception that teaching just wasn't important. It didn't matter that Professor Zilch didn't show up for 3 days and sent in a graduate student who doesn't know us, who possibly doesn't speak English. If it was in a quantitative area, that was frequently a very strong complaint. All these things kind of added to the sense that students don't matter. Nobody cares. And I think by establishing an ombudsman's office, you are sending a message that somebody cares. That doesn't mean that the ombudsman gives orders and makes policy, far from it. But if it's well established, and this one I think was well established by being directly, with a direct reporting line to the president, it doesn't mean that you're on the line with the president all the time, in fact, very infrequently, but nobody knows for sure where you're going to go and how hard you're going to, how high up you're going to go, how hard you're going to fight. Mm-hmm. And that's really where your clout comes from. And I found that it proved to be considerable.
did you find that Professor Rust's model was a good one for you to follow?
Yes, I made some changes from his period. Now, of course, I was in the office longer than he. He had been there 7 years. It was he wasn't in there physically when I took over. He had been ill. And the office was being minded by Frederick Dutton, I think as a favor to President Wharton. Dutton had been the head of Lyman Briggs School and I think now had been replaced in that capacity. Dutton was extremely kind and very helpful to me. So Russ really wasn't there when I took over. The big change that I made was that as an assistant, he had had one or two other faculty assisting him. I decided to post this as a graduate student's assistantship. And I stuck with that for my 14 years in office, and my 17 years in office actually, 17 years. And my two successors have stuck with that also. So it's a very interesting job for a graduate assistant, and these were advanced graduate assistants, mm-hmm. and people who were almost always working on their doctorate. They came from all different parts of the university, and some of them stayed a couple of years. It worked out very well because it added a point of view in the office that was not my point of view. These were people who were going through the registration hassle, and I don't know how far back you go, but registration here used to be.
I went through the pit.
It was pretty bad. I once went through registration, simply standing behind some students going through. I could only do that once, though, because then the registrar's people knew who I was, so I couldn't do it again. But it was really, it was kind of awful. And we were such a big university, and yet we seemed to have this tremendous paperwork process when other universities seemed to be going in a different, more computerized direction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we caught up with them finally. But registration was always something of a hassle. But that wasn't all. But I thought that having that young person's point of view was wonderful. These were very bright people, men and women. And I learned probably 10 times as much from them as they learned from me. Mm-hmm. But it worked out. Mm-hmm. And I was rather pleased to note that my two successors have continued to.
Did that grad assistantship have a specific title?
We're just calling graduate.
Grad assistants, okay, but they worked in your office.
Right.
What when you first started, what would you say your main duties were?
Well, I had to become known around the campus, and I did a Pilgrim's Progress. I invited myself to every college on the campus. I wrote to every dean, and the cooperation was terrific. I went to every office that I could think of, from financial aids to housing to pest management to the public safety, places that were flashpoints in office traffic. I truly did a Pilgrim's Progress that first year to try to familiarize myself with the campus, because although I had already been here for 17 years, I knew the political science department, and I knew something about my husband's department, but I didn't know anything about pest management, for example, mm-hmm. and I certainly didn't know anything about the registrar's office. And registrar and financial aides are particularly, you know, involved mm-hmm. with students because they have some commerce with each other every single term. I needed to learn the campus. I was extremely pleased that year when I wrote a report to the president, which I was commissioned to do by the Academic Freedom Report. President Wharton used the report in a way that no other president ever has since. He clipped it apart, and if I referred to a squeaky problem in, let's say, financial aids, he sent it to financial aids and said, I want to know what you're going to do about this, and you report back to me. He had a deep interest in the office working well. I found it interesting that after he left here, and he left the SUNY complex in New York and became the president of the TIAA, he established an ombudsman's office, and he sent the ombudsman here to spend a day with me.
Is that right?
And I liked that very much. Uh-huh. I needed to not only learn about the campus, but I needed to learn to handle things in a way that was going to work well. And I will give you one example which sticks in my mind very hard. I was fairly new on the job when something clearly, egregiously was wrong in one of the non-academic departments on campus. I called the head of that department, never met him before, and he was just, "You're bothering me. I've never had to deal with an ombudsman before. I do not want you to call me. I do not want to be bothered by things like this." And I hardly had time to say, "This is an error, and it is going to be very embarrassing if it isn't corrected." I was in tears after the conversation. In fact, the secretary said, "What are you crying about?" And I said, "I've just been talked to just horribly." But I didn't tell her why. Mm-hmm. I told my husband that night. I wrote a letter to this department head, big department, and I said, "After I dried my tears, I realized I did not explain to you sufficiently how important this is to be corrected." My husband said, "Tear that letter up." No tears. Mm-hmm. That's what they think a woman is going to do in the job. Just tell him in a very short note that since he doesn't want to be bothered in the future, and you do report directly to the president, you will simply tell the president